My name is Mark Torgas and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Can everyone hear me okay? Just give me a wave. Yeah, Josh asked me to come speak a little more than a week ago. My passion in this program is one-on-one work. Speaking is not my favorite thing. My knee-jerk reaction anytime that I'm asked to speak is to say no. And it's not because I don't want to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, but my knee-jerk reaction is you got the wrong guy, right? My knee-jerk reaction is I'm not sober long enough. My knee-jerk reaction is I don't believe in God as much as some other people do. And my knee-jerk reaction is there's a lot more polished speakers out there than there is me, right? But that again, I think that's my illness speaking to me again. I know that my recovery, I made the agreement right in my third step prayer, is to be of service and to help other alcoholics and to start doing things that are just flat out uncomfortable. And I'm going to say right out the door here, I am nervous and this is uncomfortable to me. I did my first talk a little over a year ago. This is my sixth one now, but only my second Zoom talk. The last Zoom talk, it went okay. To me, it didn't go very well. One of my biggest fears came true. Zoom is a different platform, right? It's there's a lot of moving parts. There's, you know, you see a lot of people doing a bunch of different things. And I'm easily distracted. And I found myself watching other people doing other things during the talk. And I got caught up watching some guy eat some chicken. And I got distracted. And on a couple occasions, I completely lost my train of thought. And what happened to me was one of my biggest fears is the fear of public humility. And I completely lost my train of thought twice. And I was just dead air, right? Now, what to me seemed like an eternity, apparently not the other people barely noticed. But what I did know is when my biggest fear came true, what I did realize is at least I didn't die, right? And that was a big realization for me is that, you know, regardless of what happens here tonight, even if I'm embarrassed myself or don't things don't flow through me the way that I wanted to flow through, that I said what I was going to do and I suited up and showed up. It took me a long time to get this program. I'm 51 years old and coming up on 7 years of sobriety. And the thing is, I wanted to get sober a lot sooner than I did. I was just looking at my big book and thinking of what my big book cost me. And I'm not sure if you can see this. This thing's being held together by duct tape, right? And I was looking at it. It's like, what did this big book cost me? And I figured this big book cost me approximately $50,000. My $10 big book cost me about $50,000. And that's probably being light. That's what I spent in treatment, in therapists, Tony Robbins, you name it, right? Private coaches, all sorts of different things. And I think all of us can look back at that with our own question. What did your big book cost you? You know, I know my $10 big book was very, very expensive. And it got me to doing a little bit of a looking, a little bit of research around the big book. Cause I'm actually absolutely in love with the big book because it has indeed saved my life. And I was doing a little bit of research on the internet and I came up with a few stats about the big book. And one of them is there's been 50 million copies of this sold. There's been 227 anonymous fellowships that have picked up the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. It's been named by Time Magazine as one of the most influential books written in English. The Library of Congress has named it as one of the books that has helped shape America. Arguably the most important thing to happen in the 20th century, millions of lives has been saved by this big book, and certainly mine has. I remember when I did my first talk, like I said, it was a little over a year ago, and I was taking these notes and writing notes and writing notes and writing notes, and I was looking at all these notes the day before my talk, and I'm looking at them, and it's like, I don't like them. I don't like any of them. And mainly because it was just another drunkalogue, right? And I don't like drunkalogues. I think that drunkalogues are war stories. I do not think they bring us together. In fact, I think that they pull us apart, right? So I'm looking at these notes, and I threw them all in the garbage. And I started reflecting on the topic of unity. It's like, what actually brings us all together? We're all from different walks of life, where we got all different stories. We're groups of people that just typically would not mix, right? So what actually brings us all together? And it brought me back into page 17 of the big book. And I'm going to do a little bit of reading from the big book here tonight. Because the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in a powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree, upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. So what it's telling me here is that regardless of where we're from, regardless of our stories, that we have a common problem and a common solution. So that to me was quite confusing in my first experiences with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was around here a long time, not knowing what it meant to be an alcoholic. And where I was from, there was an awful lot of war stories going on and not that much recovery. It was in a real pocket of watered down recovery. And I would hear somebody talk and I would hear, well, I'm an alcoholic because I've got 4 DUIs. Like, well, I don't have 4 DUIs. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Or I'm an alcoholic because I've got 7 years in prison. Like, well, I don't have 7 years in prison. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Or I'd hear another person say, well, I'm an alcoholic because I live under a bridge. Well, shit, I don't live under a bridge. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic. And it took me a while to figure out what it actually meant to be an alcoholic. So I'm going to qualify myself tonight, not by my war stories. I will talk a little bit tonight about some war stories, not much, because again, I don't think our war stories bring us together. I think they push us apart. What actually makes me an alcoholic is, well, the first thing is that, and this is how I'm going to qualify myself, and I'll use a few analogies for everything, is one, it's a physical allergy of the body, right? So what that means to me is that I process ethyl alcohol in a different fashion than the average person. About 90% of the people out there can safely drink alcohol. 10% of the population can't. For me, once I start, I absolutely cannot stop, right? Now, I can look back at my drinking career, maybe in some of my earlier years, certainly in my 20s, I'd get the odd win. But as my drinking career progressed, once I started to drink, the allergy would kick in. Like Dr. Silkworth refers to it as the phenomenon of craving. That makes absolute sense to me, right? Once I start, I have no idea when I'm going to stop. And the thing is, the allergy brought me into other areas as well, other areas I never would have visited. And I will talk, like, I truly believe in the singleness of purpose, but my story does involve some outside issues. And these outside issues, these are things I never would have done unless alcohol was on the table. You know, when I put alcohol in my body, it led me into a world of gambling. It led me into a world of drugs. It led me into a world of promiscuity with women. You know, there was a lot of other things that alcohol led me into. And, you know, it was no longer fun for me. You know, I would start drinking and then I'd finish my night with You know, I would get into outside stuff, alcohol or cocaine. I would get into gambling. I'd get into a variety of other things. And what I realized is once I started, I had absolutely no clue where this allergy was going to take me. Now, I had hit a treatment center prior to me getting sober. And one of the big things that they said to me was that all alcoholism is a result of childhood trauma. And I don't believe that to be true, right? I believe that this is I have a genetic predisposition to alcohol. And once I start, I have no idea when I'm going to stop. The thing is about this treatment center that I went to, they believe that everything was to do with childhood trauma. And I don't want to diminish childhood trauma. I know it happens to an awful lot of people. It wasn't my story though, you know? And if it happens to somebody, I'm a big believer in outside help. I think they should get help with that kind of stuff. But for me, I didn't come from a horrible home. In this treatment center, you know, they weren't going to let me leave unless I figured out what this trauma was, right? What actually happened to me? And it got really confusing for me. And if you think of it, you know, if I have a food allergy, for example, if I got a food allergy to strawberries, do you think my food allergy has anything to do with childhood trauma? Right? It just is. I have an allergy to alcohol. Once I start, I do not have any idea when I'm going to stop. And for me, it was just no longer fun at all, right? Where the allergy brought me is that late at night, you know, I'd have a few drinks with some friends. And a lot of people didn't even think I was all that bad. I would have a few drinks, but then I would disappear on them, right? I would call my dealer and I'd go home alone and I would do some outside issues. And before you know it, I'm staring out my window for hours on end with a baseball bat, right? I did not know where the allergy was going to take me. I've heard Bob D sum it up with an analogy, and I think it's quite funny. So the analogy can be, the allergy is like having sex with a gorilla. Because once you start, you have absolutely no idea when it's going to stop, right? So that, to me, makes complete sense. And my only solution to that, as per the big book, is a life of abstinence, right? This is not about harm reduction. Alcoholics Anonymous is not about harm reduction. This is about abstinence-based recovery. Because if I got an allergy, right, I need to have complete abstinence. But that's actually not where my alcoholism actually lives. It's the second part of this illness, which is the obsession of the mind. And this is where my alcoholism lives. Basically, a sober blackout. I could quit. I could quit for a woman, I could quit for a job, I could quit for my kid, but I could never stay quit. And it takes me to a spot in the big book here on page 24. And my sponsor, he refers to this as the secret handshake in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if this makes sense to you, then you're probably an alcoholic. And it's the part in italics. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Right? I don't choose if I'm going to quit drinking. The drink chooses me. If somebody says to me that they chose to quit drinking, way to go, congratulations, you're probably not an alcoholic, right? And this is where I felt weak-willed, because I thought it was a matter of willpower. Once again, I have no willpower when it comes to alcohol. Some analogies for the mental obsession for me is I would make these deals with God all the time. I remember getting my first DUI and making a deal with God. It's like, God, please, please, God, just get me out of this. And I promise not to drink anymore. And then I get my second DUI, right, and I make another deal with God. It's like, God, please, please, just help get me through this. And I promise I'll quit drinking. And then I remember being hooked up to a polygraph test. And I'm looking at doing 7 years in prison. been accused of some very major crimes. And I remember doing a deal with God yet again. God, please, please just help me get through this. And I promise I won't drink anymore. Right? And thank God that, you know, I passed the polygraph test. I was an innocent man. But the thing is, each and every one of these times, within long, I'm back drinking again. And then there was another time where I get caught with this powdery white substance in Mexico. And I'm detained by the Mexican feds, and I'm scared, like absolutely scared. The most scared I've ever been in my life. I'm handcuffed with their zip ties, and they're whispering in my ear that I'll never see my family again. And I remember making a deal with God right in that moment. God, please, please, please help me get through this. And I promise I will quit drinking and live a sober life. Each and every one of those times, you could have hooked me up to a polygraph test and I would have passed. If you are a real alcoholic, you can't scare us into sobriety. I could not be scared into a state of sobriety, right? To me, the mental obsession can be summed up with the analogy, but it's like a dog returning to its vomit. You know, if the dog was able to talk and you were to say to him, why are you doing this? Be like, you know, I know this is a bad idea. I'm not even sure why I'm doing this. I have absolutely no control and I'm just going to do it, right? To me, that's a mental obsession. And the mental obsession, this is the part that I recover from. But it takes me to the third part of this illness. And it's the spiritual malady. Now, somewhere along the line, talking about the spiritual malady has become, I guess, controversial in AA. I didn't realize that until Zoom. The mental obsession and the mental obsession and the physical allergy, those are the two that are unique to alcoholics. Over on page 44, it asks two questions. And that's what I use to qualify alcoholics. What happens when you start drinking? What happens when you stop drinking? Right? Those are the two things that are unique to alcoholics. The spiritual malady is not unique to alcoholics, but I truly believe that it's much, much, much more prominent for alcoholics than in other people. The spiritual malady is basically how I feel in a sober state. I started drinking at the age of 12, and I think I needed one at the age of 6. That's about how far I can remember where I didn't feel okay inside, right? I felt alone. I felt separate from other people. I felt alone in a group of people. I never really felt like I fit in. I was absolutely riddled in fear. I was better with alcohol. Alcohol actually took all that away, right? It helped me feel better. I was up until probably my mid-20s, alcohol was my best friend, right? It took away the fear. It made me a better person. While it still worked, but at some point in time, it quits working. So the sober state, the big book describes how I feel in a sober state with three words: restless, irritable, and discontent, right? That's me without the drink. The big book further clarifies it with some questions over on page 52. And what my sponsor taught me to do is turn statements into questions. Over on page 52, it talks about the bedevilments, and it asks, were you having trouble in personal relationships? Were you having trouble controlling your emotional nature? Were you prey to misery and depression? Were you having trouble making a happy living? Did you have a feeling of uselessness? Were you full of fear? Were you unhappy? Were you having trouble being of real help to other people? Right? That's why I drank. Because it helped me with all that. A really good analogy for me, and I've heard it before that alcoholics aren't very motivated people, and I don't believe that to be true. Alcoholics are some of the most strong and motivated people that I've ever come across, except when it comes to the first drink, except when it comes to alcohol. But I was doing some work for a real estate company out of Victoria, British Columbia, a company called Bear Mountain. And I wasn't even working as a real estate agent. I was in the Alberta oil and gas industry. And I got involved in this real estate project out there. And I somehow was able to sell 44 condos in a short period of time. Now, that was more than their entire staff combined. Now, the group of owners at Bear Mountain was a group of NHL hockey players, professional NHL hockey players. And they were quite impressed with what I had done. And they brought me out to Victoria to have a dinner in my honor, right? Because I'd done so much work and I was making them a bunch of money. And to me, it's like, I have arrived, right? Some of these guys were in the Hockey Hall of Fame. And I'm sitting with all these very famous and very popular people. Some of them are household names. And I remember sitting there with these guys. And what should have been one of the best moments of my life, I'm just sitting there and I'm feeling absolutely horrible inside. I'm just coming out of my skin in a sober state, right? That to me is the spiritual malady, right? Coming out of my skin in a sober state, feeling absolutely worthless, feeling not worthy, you know, in a situation where should have been one of the best moments in my life, feeling completely unworthy. And all I'm doing is I'm staring at the wine on the table, like, pour the wine, where's the wine, right? And I drink a glass of wine, I guzzle the glass of wine, and I'm just like, oh, this sense of absolute relief, right? We drink for the effect that alcohol produces. And then instantly I became the man that they had all thought that I was, right? In the sober state, I was absolutely caught up in the spiritual malady. So I've got a three-part problem and I got a three-part solution. One of the parts of the solution is recovery, which is the 12 steps in the spiritual program of action. Two is unity, which is the meetings and the fellowship. And three is service, which is sponsoring other alcoholics and helping other alcoholics. And frankly, doing the things that I don't want to do, self-sacrifice, right? I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous as a absolutely chronic relapser for 7 years, in and out and in and out and in and out. And the pocket of recovery that I was in, nobody was talking about the steps. It was very much meeting-based sobriety. And one of the big slogans that was going around for us at that time was 90 and 90, 90 and 90, 90 meetings, 90 days. And I remember going to 100 meetings in 90 days and wanting to put a bullet in my head. You know, and the meetings I was going to was just a lot of people complaining and bitching about traffic and bitching about divorce and just bitching and bitching. I remember leaving a meeting, and I'm still, you know, new to recovery and I don't know any better. And I've already exhausted every other options out there. And I remember just listening to this and going, leaving a meeting and going right to the bar. It's like, if this is recovery, I'm going to take my chances out there. But what I didn't realize is that this is a three-part problem and a three-part solution. And it's like sitting on a three-legged stool. If one of those legs gets taken away, I lose my balance, right? If two of those legs get taken away, I got no balance at all, right? And that's one of the things that was promised to me in early recovery, is if I live in all three parts of the solution, recovery, unity, and service, I do not have to drink again. And that was after being suffering for years and years and years in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll talk a little bit here about hitting bottom. During sobriety, I had a case of, or during, I mean, my active alcoholism, I had a case of the if onlys. I remember in my early 30s, if I had this idea of if only I could get the girl, if only if I could get the house, if only I could get the job, if only I could get the car. And through changing jobs and some hard work and maybe a little bit of good luck, I actually got everything that I thought I wanted. And I remember being in Maui, and I'm with a beautiful woman, and on paper, my life looks absolutely amazing, but I can't stop drinking, right? And I remember looking in the mirror, having everything that I thought I wanted from an external level, and looking in the mirror, I'm going, shit, it's still there, right? It's still there. That dirty, ugly alcoholism is still there. And I had these feelings of impending doom, and my bottom, it wasn't external, it was 100% internal, right? I remember for the next 30 days or so, and I wasn't drinking, but I had these feelings of absolute impending doom. I felt like I was going to die every moment of every day for about a 30-day stretch. And I'm one of these self-proclaimed atheists, self-proclaimed agnostics, you know, but I really wasn't, because I would pray if I was in trouble. I'd pray if I was in the courtroom. I'd pray for a girl to come into my life. I'd pray for a girl to leave my life. But I remember being in that position in Maui and thinking I'm going to die, not knowing what's going on. And it's funny internally how we know exactly what to do and where to go. And I started to do the Lord's Prayer. And I wasn't even sure why I was doing it. It was just my default. I started saying the Lord's Prayer because I thought, well, frankly, I thought I was going to die. Right? And something happened shortly after that. I think everyone has a defining moment between seconds or inches in their recovery where they come across a post, they hear something in a meeting, maybe they have a speaker come into their hospital. Something happens in everyone's recovery which changes their life forever. For me, my life completely changed with a click of a mouse. I was dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, 7 years as a chronic relapser, hitting my bottom, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, completely desperate internally. And I remember clicking a mouse and ending up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, an online meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous, like no other meeting I've ever been to before. This was a group that assigned me a sponsor as soon as I got there. And if I didn't like it, get out. Right? Now, of course, my feelings were hurt because I'm an alcoholic and I'm a little bit sensitive. But I was intrigued because I'd exhausted every other avenue. I've been to the treatment centers. I've been to the doctors. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, hitting meeting after meeting after meeting, and I could not get sober. And I got a group that cared more about me than my feelings. So one thing about this group is they did not care about what I thought, and they did not care about what I felt. The only thing that they cared about were my actions. And I was assigned a sponsor that day, and I was taken through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in a very, very quick fashion. They were saying some things there that I hadn't heard before. I'd been taken through the work in approximately 2 weeks. And in that 2 week time frame, something happened to me. The obsession to drink had been removed. Now, remember this. This sponsor that I had was a female out of New York, and she was very, very tough. In my pocket of recovery, I was always taught that you're supposed to call your sponsor with all your problems. And I remember calling this sponsor, wanting to talk about my feelings, wanting to talk about usually relationship issues. And the question she would always ask me is, did you help another alcoholic today? And if the answer was no, click, she would hang up the phone on me. Now, of course, I was very offended and it pissed me off, quite frankly. And I'm a tough sponsor and I'm not quite that tough. It's not what I do, but it's exactly what it was needed for me at the time. I was a skilled manipulator and I was an artful liar. And what it taught me is my ultimate pathway through this isn't going to be a dependency upon another human being. But my pathway through this was going to be helping other alcoholics, right? And that's still my default. More than prayer, more than meditation, more than meetings, more than anything, one-on-one work with other alcoholics, right? When I'm twisted up, that's my go-to, right? I do it for the effect that it produces. Same reason that I used to drink alcohol. I used to drink because I liked the effect, but it quit working. Now, for me, just to quit drinking, that's like a form of a torture. I needed a sufficient substitute. And the substitute for me is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and working with other alcoholics, right? So that's what this sponsor out in New York would have me do, right? Before she would talk to me, she made sure that I had called another alcoholic or tried to help another alcoholic that day. There's been some influential characters in my sobriety that have come along the way. I've since left my original sponsor out in New York. And approximately 6 years ago, I started, a little more than 6 years, almost 7 years ago now, I started listening to the tapes of a man by the name of Chris Raymer. And he intrigued me. He was saying some things that were blunt. He was saying all the things that I was feeling, and I became a little bit of a, I guess, a sober stalker. I was listening to one of his tapes, and I found out what treatment center that he was working at, and I sent him an email, and he responded, and I sent him another email, and he responded, and then we began to talk on the phone, and for the last 6 years, approximately about 6.5 years, Chris has been my sponsor, and I know that Josh has listened to him a lot. He's been an absolute influential character in my recovery, and I know a lot of other people as well. But one of the things with Chris, when I talked to him, one of the big things that he taught me is no dependencies, absolutely no dependencies, right? When I call him again with drama, he doesn't ask me if I've helped another alcoholic. He asked me where I'm at in the circle and the triangle, right? He has me draw the circle and the triangle. And he's like, plot yourself. Where are you? Where are you in the circle and the triangle? Right? What I do find if that spiritual malady is coming back, if I'm feeling uncomfortable in my skin in a sober state, there's usually one part of my program that I'm not working. Right? So I can visit that. Am I getting to meetings? Am I doing the 12 steps? Am I starting the morning with prayer or meditation? Am I doing an evening review? Am I actively helping other alcoholics? When's the last time I worked with a newcomer? Those are the things that we talk about. What I do find is alcoholism tends to be a disease of perception, right? The way that I look at the world is often very skewed. What I do find that when I'm working in the middle of the circle and the triangle, the things that might've been a 9 on the drama scale are no longer a 9. It's not like they're gone completely, but they're more like a 3 now, right? The drama just seems to go away when I'm working all three parts of this program. There was another individual that was that I was introduced to by the name of Dale, and he's in my community, and he's 37 years sober. Dale was he's a biker, he's a rodeoer, he's a rancher, he's tough, he knows the big book, and he's highly intimidating. And I remember when I came back to my area and talking about announcing myself as a recovered alcoholic, which caused a tremendous amount of pushback. Talking about doing the steps quickly. I'm sponsoring people at 2 months of sobriety, and I'm getting a tremendous amount of pushback. And I remember talking to Dale, and I'm like, shit, I don't even want to tell Dale what I'm up to, because he's going to be angry. He's going to be pissed. And I'm like, you know, screw it. So I told Dale what I'm up to. And he says to me, he's like, that's all a product of good sponsorship. It's exactly what you're supposed to be doing, right? That's all directly from the big book. And at last I had an ally, right, in my program here in my city, because I wasn't well received when I came back talking about doing the 12 steps quickly, talking about being a recovered alcoholic. Was not well received at all, and I've had a tremendous amount of pushback. There's been another individual. His name is Greg, Pastor Greg. Right around 8 months, 9 months of sobriety, I was working with an awful lot of alcoholics. And what I did find that there was a lot of them that weren't being honest with me in a step five. And one of my friends had lost their son to the disease of alcoholism. And I was at the funeral and I was listening to Pastor Greg speak. And he spoke really, really, really well. And the next day I'm driving, I'm still in the oil and gas industry, and I'm driving to another city. And I pull over on the side of the road and I look up the church director and I'm like, I'm not even know why I'm doing this. And I just called him out of the blue. And I'm like, I'm not even exactly sure why I'm calling you. I just feel like I'm supposed to be calling you. And I told him what I'm up to. And I'm doing a lot of these step fives. And I'm finding that a lot of the guys aren't 100% honest with me. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to get involved. And he's like, absolutely. Well, come and see me. And it started this journey with Pastor Greg in my community. And he's since gone on to do 60 or 70 step fives in my community, you know. But I remember having a conversation with him. And I gave him a copy of the big book. And he says to me, he says, I got a little bit of a beef with your program. I'm like, oh, really? Like, what is that? He goes, well, you got to tell people that you're always going to be sick for the rest of your life. You got to tell everyone that you're always going to be recovering. Like, that's actually not true. Right. And I showed him the very first promise in the big book, the story of how thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Right. That we're supposed to draw attention to ourselves, the newcomer, as people who have recovered. And he's like, I didn't know that. And he drew the attention to the word restored in the Bible, right? Now, recovered doesn't mean I'm cured, doesn't mean I'm better than anyone, but it just simply means the obsession to drink has been removed and I am well today, you know? And that's to me is the biggest miracle of my life. I'm not gonna tell anyone from the podium that I'm still sick when I'm not. So that was encouraging for him. What it's like now. Let me just backtrack here. There's another thing that took place here in recovery. I was getting a tremendous amount of pushback and I started sharing some articles with another member in my community. His name was Ryan H. And it was just a couple of us sharing a few articles and sharing a few talks and this group started to grow. And a few more people. And I didn't want to be known as the trusted authority. And so in the middle of the night, this name came to me and it was called Solution to Recovery. So I got up in the middle of the night, I registered this domain and I got a new email address. And I started sending the emails and the recovery talks through this new email address. And I found this group just grew and grew and grew and grew. Google ended up deeming me as spam. We became too big for the platform. So we had to move everything over into MailChimp. And this group now has become, well, I've got well over 300 people now on this group, you know, and these are some of the amazing things that can happen in recovery. You know, I didn't see any of that kind of stuff coming. You know, it was just a couple of alcoholics sharing a few articles and it grew into something a lot bigger than me because I've decided to go ahead and continue to help other alcoholics as a way of life. But what it's like now, my life has got purpose. Like I mentioned, the solution to recovery, that's been a real big part of my life. I've given a chance to meet all sorts of people from all over the world. I've got a chance to have a fellowship grow up around me. I've got through Zoom. This Zoom thing has been, you know, it's different, but boy, has it been awesome. I've made a number of really cool friendships all over the world. But the biggest thing for me is what it's like now for me. The biggest thing for me is I'm free from the obsession. You know, I've heard all sorts of absolutely wonderful stories of people when they get into recovery and their life is absolutely a highlight reel. And that's amazing. I absolutely love hearing those kind of stories. But it wasn't the case for me. My first 4 years of sobriety were filled with a tremendous amount of tragedy. My dad had died, and I didn't obsess to drink. My mom had died, and I didn't obsess to drink. I've had a number of family members die. My family's been ripped apart, you know? And at no point in time have I been obsessed to drink. And to me, that's the biggest miracle in my life. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, you people helped me with that. You know, Trace, I couldn't even have lunch without a drink or some sort of mind-altering substance in me before. And now I'm going through some of the most horrible things in my life with an element of grace and dignity. I got a chance to speak at my father's funeral. I got a chance to do the eulogy. You know, there's no way I could have ever done that without Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no way I've ever could have done that without you people. And I remember the night before my father's eulogy, I was destroyed, absolutely destroyed, right? I didn't think I'd be able to do it. And I remember getting a call. There's a guy out from Boston that I sponsor. I remember getting a call from him. And I didn't tell him about my father's death. He was hurting. He was going through some things. And I went through a 12-step call with this guy from Boston. And what I found was my spirits were absolutely lifted. You know, lack of power is my dilemma. Not lack of faith, lack of power. And when I'm working with other alcoholics, I'm given something way beyond me. You know, I did that 12-step call before the night before my dad's funeral. And I was able to go the next day and deliver a very, very, very good eulogy. And it was one of the most important things that I've ever done. And honestly, I don't know if I could have done that if I wouldn't have taken that 12-step call the night before. Right? What a cool thing that is. I've had an amazing relationship with my son. You know, he knows what I do. He sees a constant parade of men coming in and out of the house. We're talking about recovery. We're talking about the big book. My phone's constantly ringing. And I'm completely transparent with him. He thinks it's a pretty cool thing. I bring him to the birthday meetings. You know, he thinks it's a really cool thing. And I guess if there's one thing that I want to share with anyone out there is, you don't have to wait to get well, right? That was one of the biggest things that was said to me. The misconceptions for me in early recovery is like, you have to take your time, wait a year, you know, these kind of things, step a year. I'm telling you, you don't have to wait to get well. You can get well, and you can get well really, really quickly. How am I doing for time, Josh? I got a few minutes. I'm just going to finish up with an article here, and I've read it at a couple of other talks. It's from someone in my sponsorship lineage out in Toronto, and I've shortened it up considerably, and I've shortened it up even more. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs from this article, and it's a guy out in Toronto that's in my sponsorship lineage, and it's called Confessions of a Big Book Sponsor. It says, I remember asking someone in the fellowship a few years ago, "Are you working your program?" He replied, "Yes, I went to a meeting today." I responded, "No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with someone?" He said, "Yes, I have a sponsor." I replied, "No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with a newcomer?" He said, "I'm just a few months sober. I'm only a newcomer myself. This is a selfish program. I need to work on myself first." I never saw him again. What do I do? You'll find me at 12-step meetings armed with the facts about myself. As an ex-problem drinker, you'll see me making an approach to the newcomer, looking for someone who needs and wants to hear about our common solution, someone with an honest desire to stop drinking, someone who wants what I have and is willing to follow the instructions as outlined in the big book, someone who wants to be joyous and free of active alcoholism. I've carried the message of the big book to many alcoholics, and I've rarely seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Untreated alcoholics are unlovely people. My struggles with them are strenuous, comic, and tragic. Those who could not or would not see our way of life are often consumed by their temptation, which leads them into the gates of insanity or death. I have worked hard with many alcoholics on the idea that only an alcoholic can help another alcoholic. I've had many failures. I once asked another big book sponsor about their success rate, and she replied, "I'm 100% successful." Astounded, I asked, "How is that possible?" She replied, "I'm still sober." That to me is the best kept secret in our fellowship today. I often hear that this is a selfish program, but whenever I put my sobriety first, I could never stay sober. When I started showing the newcomer how to stay sober, I found no trouble staying sober. As Dr. Bob once remarked, strenuous work one-on-one with another alcoholic was vital to permanent recovery. In 12-step rooms, I've been accused of being a step Nazi, a big book thumper, a holy roller, a zealot, a big book page pusher, and recently I was called a step tard. I have been thrown out of groups and asked not to come back. I've been asked not to bring my big book into some AA meetings. I've been physically and verbally threatened by members of the fellowship for teaching that the 12-step program can be learned in a week. I've been blamed for killing people with the big book. When confronted with such animosity, my program tells me I have to look at my part. Have I been crusading, righteous, or critical? Have I been engaging in frothy debates or windy arguments? Have I been demonstrating an attitude of intolerance? Yes, I have been times when I've been all those things, but I claim spiritual progress, not perfection, and I am no saint. Over the years, I've witnessed a fellowship grow up around me. I've watched a spirit grow in the eyes of the suffering individual and seen them recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I've seen them make a 180-degree turn in life, only to help some other suffering alcoholic do the same. This is the experience I would not miss. I know you would not want to miss it either. Frequent contact with newcomers and other big book sponsors is the bright spot in my day. A vision for you. Thus I grow spiritually, and so can you with the big book in your hand. It contains all you will need to begin working with the alcoholic who still suffers. I know what you are thinking. I'm a newcomer myself. I do not have enough sobriety time to be of useful to anyone. What could I possibly offer another cute newcomer? Maybe I should wait a year or two. Rubbish. By working the big book solution, you will tap into a source of power greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what I've accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. Remember, your reliance is always upon your higher power. It will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Ask in morning meditation what you can do for the alcoholic who still suffers. The answers will come to you if you work your program, but if you're on shaky ground, you better work with another alcoholic instead. Remember, you have recovered and have been given the power to help others. You will soon find out when all other measures fail, work with another alcoholic will save the day. Give freely of what you have been shown and join us on the broad highway of fellowship of the Spirit. You'll surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Trust God, clean house, and help others. Thank you, everyone.